Well, thanks, Pip. Thanks, Stephen. And thanks very much to the organisers of today's event, the Australian Business Economists and the Women in Economics Network, for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today. It really is a pleasure, and particularly it's great to see some of the students here. Today, I'd like to talk about an important driver of future prospects for the Australian economy, the pickup in global economic activity that began in the second half of last year. How did we pick up that this was happening, and how might conditions evolve over the period ahead? During 2015 and 2016, the tone of commentary about the global economy was quite negative. Yes, there had been a slowing evident in the data, particularly from China. Yet this alone would not explain it. Things seemed fragile. Growth forecasts were being revised down. Experience suggested that the mood should have been more buoyant. Policy was accommodating the recovery from the global and European financial crises. But there was a fall in commodity prices, particularly oil prices. Declines in oil prices are typically seen as expansionary because they often imply that supply has increased, and that was exactly what OPEC was doing. Lower oil prices also often support growth. Most of Australia's major trading partners are net oil importers and are better off if the price of oil declines relative to other prices. But rather than being a catalyst for growth, lower oil prices were an indicator of weakening global demand. This in turn spurred an unusually large pullback in energy-related business investment in some economies, and this exacerbated the downturn in global economic activity. For commodity exporting emerging markets, growth was impeded by lower commodity prices, on top of any domestic factors driving growth. Previously, the negative effects of lower oil prices on producers would have been outweighed by the positive effects on spending by net oil importing countries. This time around, the opposite occurred. The net effect was negative. Commodity exporters' demand for traded goods produced elsewhere declined noticeably over 2015 and early 2016. This had spillover effects on other economies highly exposed to global trade, particularly in Asia. The Asian region was also affected by concerns circulating about risks in China. It's worth contrasting the experience of these commodity exporters with Australia, or with an economy more exposed than Australia to oil prices, such as Canada. Falling commodity prices reduced Australia's terms of trade and thus our income. There was a debate about whether the Australian dollar had depreciated by enough to offset that effect. But the net effect of lower commodity prices and the exchange rate was smaller in some other economies. The lower exchange rate had gone some of the way to cushioning the income effects of the lower terms of trade. It also contributed to helping some parts of the non-mining economy pick up. Now, late last year, the negative sentiment and rhetoric around the global economy started to turn around. Clearly, there was a recovery in the data, but the recovery in the accompanying rhetoric was even more marked. To the extent that perception affects people's expectations, this had the potential to influence actual outcomes. Perhaps one way to show this is to look at the text from reports by key economic agencies. If you contrast the words most frequently used in the first chapter of the April 2016 IMF World Economic Outlook with the same chapter from a year later, you can see how the tone has changed. Another way to characterise this change in tone is that in the April 2016 edition, around 6% of the keywords coded as positive and 10% as negative. A year later, more than 13% of the words were considered positive, compared with about 5% negative. At first, the turnaround seemed to be only in soft indicators of sentiment, such as business surveys and financial market prices. The Global Purchasing Managers' Indices, a commonly used measure of surveyed business conditions, hit bottom and started to turn around in late 2016. Commodity prices also started to lift. Over time, however, clearer signals started to emerge that this was more than just people feeling optimistic. there was something real happening as well. Growth in merchandise exports was the next to pick up. Soon afterwards, it became clear that growth in industrial production was also increasing. It should be noted that throughout this period, the swings in the actual data were never very large, certainly not relative to the crisis period. By the time we reached early 2017, there were further signs that the pickup in trade and other high-frequency indicators were flowing through to various countries' national accounts. Particularly welcome was the recovery in investment growth, which can now be seen in a range of major economies and regions. As well as broadening across different measures of activity, the expansion also broadened across countries and regions. In the latest statement on monetary policy, the Reserve Bank emphasised the broad-based nature of the pickup across both sources of exports and destinations of imports. The boost to incomes from rising commodity prices has also helped economic prospects of commodity exporters. Some of them have emerged from recessions and are now increasing their demand for production from the rest of the world. Now, the sequence of events that I've just described to you is a turning point. And as any economic forecaster could tell you, a turning point is essentially impossible to predict. But it does seem that many observers, including the bank, managed to notice that turning point in near real time. In the overview of the November 2016 Statement on Monetary Policy, the first sentence read, "Growth in Australia's major trading partners remains a bit below average and is expected to decline a little over the forecast period, reflecting a further moderate easing in growth in China." Shortly after its publication, markets rallied following the US election outcome. It wasn't clear that the policies of the incoming administration would be expansionary overall. The expected fiscal stimulus would have been, but the announced trade policies were rightly seen as likely to harm global growth. Many observers thought the election outcome would be negative for financial market pricing. So it was understandable to downplay reactions when markets instead rose. Then, over the Southern Hemisphere summer, it became clear that this was more than a financial market reaction to political events in one country. The outlook had become more positive. The first sentence of the February 2017 SMP overview, just 3 months later, read, "The global economy entered 2017 with more momentum than earlier expected." The facts had changed, and we had changed our minds. The nature and pattern of the pickup in the data convinced us. The first aspect of the shift that helped convince us was the broadening of the pickup from sentiment indicators, including financial market pricing, to measures of physical activity. Growth in global trade was the first place this became apparent. Industrial production in a range of countries followed soon afterwards. The second aspect was the broad-based spread of the pickup across countries and regions. If it had just been one country, say China, demanding all the extra imports, there would have been less reason to revise the outlook. To identify a turning point as it happens, you need to have a sound analytical framework for thinking about how the economy works and how all the various indicators fit together. One thing to bear in mind is that trade is often, though not always, highly leveraged to global activity. When global activity picks up, trade picks up by more. This is partly because demand for traded merchandise tends to be a bit more cyclical than the services sector, where much output is not traded across borders. It's also the result of global supply chains. You can imagine a situation where final stage production globally increases by one unit, but almost all of the value added crosses three foot borders before reaching its destination. Global exports, or imports, would then pick up by close to three units. It's also reasonable to expect that in the first instance, an unexpected increase in demand for goods and materials might be met on global markets, because often not every product or input is produced in every country. Another point to bear in mind is that in recent upswings, investment has usually tended to come later. This wasn't always the way. But in recent times, businesses have tended to wait till they see evidence of increased demand before they invest in expanding capacity. They're even less likely to invest to expand when there's plenty of spare capacity, a legacy of the crisis. We also know that businesses are more likely to invest in things that boost labour productivity when the labour market is tight, not when there's considerable slack. So in the current environment, we would not expect business investment to be at the leading edge of a pickup in global economic activity. And we have to be willing to call the pickup before we see it in business investment. A third point to be mindful of is that the data are noisy and can be revised. So we need to triangulate multiple data sources against each other. Survey measures of sentiment and other supposed leading indicators are not the whole story. They tell you something, but they should not be taken as gospel on their own. But neither should you wait until you see the whites of the National Account's eyes before you change your view. All data are noisy, including the National Account's. By the time you've seen something in the National Accounts and are sure it isn't just noise, several quarters will have passed. If you wait that long, you will be well behind the curve in catching a change in economic momentum. Now that we've seen this pickup in global activity, we must then ask, what next? Will the expansion continue at its current rate, pick up further, or peter out? Part of the question here is whether expansions can continue unabated or whether something forces them to die of old age. One could argue that this is a relatively new upswing. But many economies have in fact been expanding ever since the end of the global financial crisis and are now quite close to being at full capacity. Countries such as the United States and Japan are generally regarded as being already more or less at full employment. Does this mean they can't keep going like this for much longer? Well, the academic literature at least seems to suggest that long-lived recessions are no more likely to end than shorter ones, at least beyond some point. I think we can take some comfort from that. We should then ask whether we would expect the current expansion to be any different from past expansions. A common pattern is that expansions end because they came together with an unsustainable build-up in leverage. And globally, leverage does not seem to have increased much this time around. At least it hasn't increased to the extent seen in the lead-up to the global financial crisis. Of course, there are some areas where debt has increased rapidly and in ways that deserve further investigation. But whether credit expansions pose a problem isn't always clear-cut, except in hindsight. So we should be cautious when we see them, and we should factor them into our assessments of how long an expansion might last, but we shouldn't assume that this expansion is due for a fall. In thinking about how long and how strong the global expansion could be, a lot will depend on productivity growth. This isn't the place to dwell on the secular stagnations debate in detail, but I will note that productivity itself can be cyclical. Productivity growth has been weak in some major advanced economies. It's not clear that this will continue once spare capacity in these economies has been fully absorbed. I also note that some of the pessimism about productivity is happening alongside great optimism in some quarters about a new industrial revolution built on better algorithms. The truth may well lie somewhere in the middle. It might also take a while to assert itself. Those of us who remember the 1990s will recall that there have been previous episodes where considerable innovations seem to be happening, but this took a while to be evident in the productivity data. This is because firms take a long time to adapt their business models and processes to the new technologies. And the greatest spur to change is capacity constraints. Tight economies spur process innovation. When there is plenty of spare capacity, not even strong competition necessarily induces higher rates of adoption of new technologies. Taking all that into consideration, there seems a reasonable prospect that, as long as nothing really bad happens, this global expansion could continue for a while. This is especially so if the technology optimists are right about the implications of recent innovations. But of course, there are risk scenarios that have the potential to derail the current economic momentum. Foremost of these at present would be geopolitical risks. These are particularly difficult risks to integrate into a macroeconomic analytical framework. We aren't political analysts. And I question whether anyone can truly know what the odds of certain events occurring might be. But we can at least think about what those risks might be and whether they might be increasing or receding. I think it's fair to say that geopolitical risks in Europe, and specifically the euro area, have receded. While it remains to be seen how Brexit will play out from a practical perspective, an existential crisis for the euro area and the EU more broadly no longer seems so close. Against that, geopolitical risks in Asia have increased. These are the low probability, high impact events that can only ever be a risk to one's forecasts. Until something actually happens, they do not and should not affect the central scenario. And even if you knew for sure that an event had happened, the economic effects are often difficult to predict. Financial risks will also be ever-present as risks to a macroeconomic outlook, and they're almost as hard as geopolitical risks are to quantify. One that seems to be becoming less pertinent at the moment is the international risk posed by ongoing low interest rates and the resulting search for yield by investors. Now that policy interest rates globally are starting to rise, if only slowly, the urgency of the search for yield surely becomes less pressing. On the domestic front, the bank has repeatedly pointed to the issues associated with household sector balance sheets. These are probably best regarded as a potential exacerbating factor. That is, if some other shock should come along, debt would make it worse. Of itself, the level of indebtedness is unlikely to be a triggering factor that sparks a negative outcome. But it's an important consideration in the context of other triggers. The risk profile of recently originated debt has improved as a result of various actions by the regulators, the evolving risk environment, and the lenders' responses. The level of debt owed matters most when the borrower is facing a large negative shock. Strong lending standards mitigate the effects of moderate shocks and can help prevent a shock turning into a default event. But even in the face of a large economy-wide shock, even the best lending standards might not be enough to protect borrowers and lenders. At that point, the absolute amount of debt owed becomes the binding consideration. A final risk to mention is the global monetary policy environment, together with the economic and market reactions to it. Expansionary monetary policy and less contractionary fiscal policy have supported economic recoveries. Some economies are now thought to be close to full employment and productive capacity. Yet so far, growth in both prices and wages has remained quite low. We believe that ultimately the forces of supply and demand do assert themselves. Wage growth and inflation should therefore pick up in these economies at some point. However, it could take a while. If productivity growth is indeed cyclical, it will start to pick up over time in these economies. So it will take longer to hit the capacity constraints that induce price rises. On the other hand, stronger potential growth is clearly a positive for economic welfare more broadly. If this scenario happens, and inflation stays low despite reasonable growth in a range of economies, policymakers in those countries will face a challenge. In that scenario, their policy still needs to remain appropriately expansionary while avoiding further build-up of leverage and financial risk. Calibrating the pace of withdrawal of stimulus will be no easy task. Policy globally will therefore need to adapt to the evolving momentum in national and global economies. To sum up, the global economy is looking better than it did a year ago. The turning point was around the end of last year. While it doesn't seem to have picked up further recently, neither is this expansion a flash in the pan. That is positive news for the Australian economy too. Noticing that change in momentum required economic forecasters to be alert to the right indicators and have the right framework for thinking about the signals that these indicators send. Nothing is ever clear-cut. There are always uncertainties about the data. There are times when you have to be willing to make a call, because waiting until you're 100% sure things have changed means waiting too long. And that means taking a view and being willing to evolve that view as new data come in, just as we've always done. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much, Lucy, for that really detailed presentation, and you know, lots of food for thought there. As I mentioned earlier, Lucy's agreed to answer questions. So if you do have a question, please, raise your hand and then state your name and affiliation, and then we'll try and get through as many as possible. And as I said earlier, I really would encourage the students here today to take this opportunity. So who would like to go first? One up the back there.
Is there a microphone?
No, I don't think so. You'll
just have to shout.
Just come a bit closer.
Well, I've got nothing. So just for the recording, the question was, I stated that globally monetary policy needed to stay expansionary while inflation remained low, and then I was asked to describe what that means for Australia, and my answer is that I'm not going to speculate about the forward path for monetary policy. I don't have anything to add beyond what was in the minutes yesterday. Sure.
And how that is really helping to inform a view of changes in view, because I think that's extremely interesting for many of us, and your point about waiting too long, being able to use technology to assess changes in sort of sentiment are very critical. So I'd be really interested in some insights here.
Well, thanks for that question. Tanya's just asked for me to talk a little bit about the word clouds and how we did the sentiment analysis. And I'm going to demonstrate something Pip said. We did this in Mathematica. There is actually a sentiment analysis package and a word cloud a function in Mathematica. So this was like only about four lines of code. It's disgusting how easy it is nowadays. One of the things we've learned about looking at sentiment analysis for various things is it doesn't work. These things are all calibrated on social media posts. And so the standard packages that are out there do not work well for central bank communication, which is far too nuanced. I don't know why you think that's funny. So what we actually did is we went through and broke up. You strip out all the simple words like, you know, and but and with. There's a footnote in the written version of the speech that talks a little bit about it. But I have to admit, the actual way we coded for this particular word cloud is we just coded the words individually because it was all pretty obvious. I did it on whether inflation was good or bad in the current environment. I decided to code it red rather than blue. But you can kind of see, yes, there's words like recovery and increase and growth in the April 2016 chapter, which are used quite frequently. But, you know, weak, decline, low. I mean, just even the fact that some of the top words, you know, decline in low and growth in April 2016, and then in April 2017 it's growth and increase and strong and inflation and recovery, high, support. You know, it was pretty obvious how to code it manually for a small data set. I hope that over time, there are some other central banks doing more on this. There's a great Bank of England paper on text mining. So I think these tools are going to start getting used more frequently as people gain experience. So this one was a little bit of a first dip our toe in the water, but it is something we're doing a little bit more of and experimenting with to see if it... I mean, we wouldn't use this as for predictive content, but I felt it was a really good way to illustrate the point. And, we tried a couple of different ways to do sentiment analysis to demonstrate that the rhetoric really had changed over those 12 months, and I thought this was a good way to show it. It's up the front here.
Yes, Michael Potter from the Financial Services Council. I'm wondering just on that topic whether you've actually made use of search terms. That's a sort of a similar idea, but it's sort of, in a sense, crowdsourcing. What are people interested in? It may not be quite as simple because you might not really think if people search in growth does not necessarily mean that, that the economy is growing. But is that something which you have been thinking about?
As I said, some of our research team, we've been dipping our toe in the water. It's not something that we've integrated in sort of a ongoing way into our normal sort of board briefing or anything like that. I haven't showed the board. I don't think I'm giving away too much to say I've never showed the board a word cloud. But I think what we're generally seeing is there are uncertainty indices that various other analysts have put together. There's a range of different things that people are now thinking possible. We certainly have used sort of the Google Books word searches and the Google Ngrams just to sort of, but again, it's not something that we'd ever put in a regression. It's more, and here's another illustration. It's kind of it's for exposition rather than for analysis at this stage.
Sure. I'm just wondering, you mentioned that growth in the world is picking up, but wages growth isn't really.
It's a great question, Tapas. He asked, for the benefit of the recording, he asked why wages growth globally hadn't really picked up, even though economies are looking a lot better. The governor talked about this in some detail in the most recent parliamentary testimony. There are a number of things going on, and I don't think we have sort of a completely nailed down answer. And I mean, I think this is the thing, what we do involves uncertainties. We'll never be 100% sure, but a couple of things are going on that we think are relevant. One is most of these economies, if they've gotten to full employment, it's only really recently happened, and lags matter. We have actually seen wage growth pick up a touch in the US and in Japan, which is the other country where they're obviously at closer to full employment or at full employment. You don't see it in the kind of regular workers who are sort of ongoing, but you are seeing a reasonably noticeable pickup in wage growth in the sort of part-time and non-regular workers. And so there's a real two-tier labour market in Japan, and we are seeing that. I mean, and certainly talking to our counterparts over in Japan, I mean, they regard the economy there as pretty hot now in terms of what it's doing to the labour market, which is great because, I mean, if you look at their age-adjusted participation rate, they're bringing people into the workforce relative to what you would otherwise expect. It's a great outcome after such a long period of quite low growth there. So lags are probably something. There is a bit of pickup of wage growth, just not very much. Lags probably have something to do with it. And as the governor has said before, there probably is also just sort of the psychological thing of a sense in which the world has become more globalised. Your competition could be all over the world. With crowdsourcing and all of these other things, a lot of people may well feel a bit more insecure in their jobs. We know that in Australia, voluntary quit rates have actually come down. So there's something going on, and I think it's something that we're looking into on an ongoing basis. Yeah. So there's I might actually, just to keep it even on tables, there's a question up the back which may well be from a school. I don't know. No. Oh, hello, sorry, I'm not wearing glasses, so I didn't recognise you.
You mentioned in your speech household sector leverage on the domestic front, and we know they're about to speak up. The board was briefed on latest developments in the housing sector this month, and talked about how, for the first time, having not had enough houses built to keep up with population growth, we've had that reversed.
Thanks, Jess. For the benefit of the recording, I'm not going to be able to repeat back all of that question, but essentially I was asked for my views on the property market, particularly in Sydney, and whether the increase in supply of apartments would weigh on prices. You're quite right that we're now at a point where, after a long period of population growth having increased significantly in the mid-2000s beyond housing supply's capacity to meet that. Housing supply has now come on and is now very high, and if anything, we are now, you know, either eating into an undersupply or building up an oversupply, depending on your perspective. And that's particularly concentrated in apartment markets. Over the years, we've pointed more to Melbourne and to Brisbane as where that's more likely to be the, where that's more likely to cause trouble in terms of concentrated increases in supply resulting in lower prices and therefore potentially distress, because they were much more geographically concentrated increases in supply. Whereas in Sydney, it's sort of all over the city, so it's much more evenly spread, and it's sort of less likely to kind of create a really concentrated local price effect. A couple of things sort of happened more recently are that we've now got to the point of sort of peak building approvals. Building approvals have stepped down to a new level. The backlog or the pipeline of work yet to be done in residential property is now starting to decline, even in New South Wales and Victoria, but particularly in Queensland. So in some sense, this is, you know, this is a phase that will eventually end, and we won't be, you know, building more than the population requires. I think one thing that probably at the margin makes me feel a little bit more confident about Melbourne than I would have, say, 3 years ago in terms of this risk is that population growth into Victoria and Melbourne in particular has been really strong, and that's not something that was envisaged earlier, and so in some sense the demand's increased, and so there's less risk of oversupply there. Similarly, population growth remains fairly strong in Sydney, so it's not clear to me that we'd end up with a serious problem here because of the geographic spread. Where we've been most concerned is Brisbane, because again it was a concentrated geographic spread of the apartment market. A lot of that new supply is coming on this year. So, you know, this year is crunch time. The pipeline of work yet to be done in Queensland has actually come off quite a way. And so, you know, it's a bit more in balance there, but the properties that are more likely to fall in price there are not the ones that have newly been built, because what will be happening is, you know, tenants will move from the five-year-old apartment to the nice new one that's even nicer, because rents are staying low. And so it'll be that kind of five-year-old, you know, not new anymore second-hand apartment market where you might see some people make losses. But again, you know, housing prices haven't been growing particularly strongly in Brisbane for a while, and particularly apartment prices. So, you know, yes, you know, it's a truism that the more supply you have, the weaker prices are going to be relative to what would have happened if supply had been lower. But at this stage, we're not seeing that as being a serious, that supply in and of itself is going to create a big fall in prices, and certainly not in Sydney. I mean, more generically, price growth has, you know, had been very strong in Sydney late last year and also in Melbourne. And as we've said in our public statements, the apartment, both the housing and apartment markets have slowed a bit in both Sydney and Melbourne, more so in Sydney than Melbourne. But price is still, you know, rising at a reasonably rapid clip nonetheless. Okay, yeah, here.
Ivan Cahoon from NAB. I was just wondering if I could ask a conceptual inflation target question.
Okay.
How would you think about the appropriate stance of policy in a world where inflation continued to undershoot your target, but unemployment was low and was falling and became quite low?
Well, I think that kind of depends on what that low, what that tight labour market is doing to labour costs, and therefore to prices. You know, that's the clear nexus. I mean, look, you know, we have full employment is in our act. So if we have low inflation and full employment, that's great. I think the other thing, this of a conceptual point I'd make, is that the inflation target that we have is sort of an on average over the medium term target. So the board can make a choice about, you know, if it's, you know, outside of the band, it can it has a choice and can make a judgment about how quickly it wants to get back. So I think the answer would depend on where you thought your forecasts were going. If in that scenario you described, our inflation forecasts were, you know, we were starting below 2 and it was going down, you know, obviously that would be a very different policy scenario to one more like the forecast that we've recently published, which is where actually, you know, slowly they're going up. And so, you know, the question is, do you want to go faster than that or not? And as the governor's said in the past, I think they're comfortable with the speed at which we're getting back. Wait too long to decide that the global economy is strong. I mean, I think that's the thing. I mean, what I'm talking about here about waiting too long is waiting too long to form a view about something. So it's funny you should mention, Rory, that comment by Ed McFarlane, because that was actually one of the things I was thinking about when I decided to pick this topic for the speech, was what he said. I probably should have put the quote in, but I couldn't remember where it was. Yeah, I couldn't find it either, but I remember it too. But yeah, so I think, you know, we need to be mindful of what's going on in the global economy, but I guess what I would respond to that is if I had two pieces of information, the other one would be the amount of slack in the Australian economy. And our assessment is there's still a fair bit of slack in the labour market. One of the things we've been wrestling with over recent times is, you know, exactly how much there is. You know, is the unemployment rate all you need to look at, or how important is underemployment? Does it matter now that the labour market's become more flexible? Does that mean that the lags between a tightening labour market and labour costs, and therefore prices, will be slower and weaker? They're the things that we're wrestling with at the moment. So, yeah. So I think the first point I make is that, you know, this is a, you know, my topic today I chose because the global economy is a really important influence on the Australian economy. And of course, you know, the previous governor was talking, you know, quite some time ago.
Two governors ago,
exactly. So in that respect, you know, I think, you know, one of the things that has changed, of course, in recent times has been the increase in the role of the resource sector in the Australian economy. I mean, that wasn't the case when Ian McFarlane was speaking on that occasion. So firstly, things have changed. Secondly, the amount of slack really matters. And, you know, I think that's also an important consideration.
Thank you. Carol, is
that? Carol, and then at the back, yeah.
The consensus forecast, the economic had growth bottoming and rebound. The same thing for interest rates, bottoming and rebounding. Every year, we're talking a decade, but we had them bottoming and rebounding. So clearly, we didn't learn a great deal from the statement made the previous year. The Fed's come out and said they think their inflation forecasting model is not working, and they go back to first principles. Are there insights that we can draw from a decade of getting the rebound?
Absolutely. It's an excellent question, Carol, that, you know, given all the, you know, the economic community more generally, you know, consistently made certain mistakes, and, you know, turning points are sort of impossible. So the bank does have a process of annual forecast reviews. I think, you know, there have been some things lately that we've been kind of getting reasonably. If you look at I mean, at that very, you know, in that particularly in that sort of now cast and very short term forecast, I think we've been reasonably okay on that just lately. But you know, one of the things that is very difficult is, you know, things like investment. I think there was a long period where we were forecasting a much stronger increase in non-mining and business investment than actually transpired, although it is now increasing. So I feel more comfortable forecasting a recovery once it's actually started, I think, is, you know, part of the issue. And so that's the thing is, so, you know, you might not be able to, forecast the recovery or the turning point adequately, but at least if you notice it quickly, yeah, and that's really the moral of my whole talk. But, yeah, so we've certainly learnt a bit about that. And I think one of the things we've learned, and, you know, as you know, Carol, you know, I spent 10 years away from monetary policy and came back at the end of last year. And so sort of, you know, the things that Rip Van Winkle has learned, among them, you know, just how important the mining sector and the spillovers from mining to other sectors turned out to be. Particularly for certain parts of the business services sector. And I think that was probably something that initially we underappreciated and have a better appreciation of this time around. And, you know, that judgment of all the, you know, the terms of trade did come up a bit more than we expected. I mean, forecasting commodity prices is at least as fruitless as forecasting the exchange rate. So, you know, that's always going to be a big swing variable that we are going to struggle with forecasting. At the moment, you know, we do expect that, you know, iron ore prices will step down from where they are, but I don't think we were really expecting them to swing up quite so much. And so understanding industrial structure, understanding, you know, what's really going on with the Chinese steel market, understanding those sort of industrial organisation things is something that I think central banks and other economic forecasters are doing much more of than they did when I was last doing monetary policy things. So up the back, there was a question. Thanks. That was Sophia Rodriguez asking about the importance of India and particularly to the iron ore and steel markets in the future relative to where it is now and where China is now. So the reference is to a passage in the minutes where we described a little sequence of graphs that I showed the board on the iron ore market and steel market and what we think some of the drivers there are. So as well as having special papers, you know, sometimes we'll just have a bit of a special theme in the presentations. There's, you know, nothing particular to infer from the timing of that other than it was a good time to do it and the team had done the work. So I showed it to the board earlier this month. And so the essential message is that countries tend to go through a phase of development where the amount of steel per capita they consume increases. And that goes up as income per capita goes up. And then there's this sort of inflection point where it flattens out. And China is exactly at that inflection point. China has been completely typical relative to many other countries, now industrialised countries, that have, you know, in terms of its steel production or consumption in particular. So what we infer from that is, you know, China is the overwhelming customer for exported iron ore. Or it has some of its own, but nowhere near enough to meet its domestic needs. And so if you want to know about the export iron ore market, you need to know about Chinese demand. And we infer from this sort of relationship that we're quite likely to be close to the point of, you know, peak steel in terms of Chinese demand. They're now at the point where their steel production per capita is likely to level off, and given their demographics, that means the absolute amount will probably also level off, maybe in the next couple of years. That's a medium-term forecast, not a short-term forecast. At the moment, I think the dynamics are actually a bit more positive than that. So turning to India, India doesn't produce anywhere near as much steel. It's actually a little bit below the curve that you tend to see in other countries, given its current income levels. I think that's partly because India went straight to a services-oriented economy rather than having that real industrialisation phase that many other countries went through. So it may well end up being a bit below the typical curve for steel production per capita, but then again, it may change that, because a lot of the steel is, you know, infrastructure and, you know, residential construction and things like that. That's where it goes into. So you could see a bit of a fillip there, but I don't expect it to be quite as heavy industry-oriented as China has been. It is nowhere, given its income levels, it's nowhere near that peak steel per capita production. And but on the other hand, it has a lot of its own iron ore. So I don't know enough about its iron ore reserves to know how much it would seek to import iron ore should its steel production rise a lot. It seems likely, given that the two low-cost producers in the world are Australia and Brazil, that if it does, Australia will be an important supplier. But I think a lot depends on how India's industrial structure evolves over the next couple of decades. It's growing, its population's still growing, so it's still a growing market, but it does have a lot of its own iron ore, and I think that's an important difference with China, which has some iron ore but not anywhere near enough to meet its domestic needs. Thanks for the question. Well, this is just simply the first chapter out of each of the IMF World Economic Outlooks. So that the next one comes out in October, so I don't have an update. So in terms of, you know, we wanted to, you know, instead of just taking what everyone's views are, we wanted to do something simple for exposition purposes today. And so we just took the WEO first, you know, the first chapter of the World Economic Outlook. And that then sort of means that you're not getting messed up by, it's, you know, different people speaking and someone's bullish and someone's bearish, and, you know, you've got to worry about who you're who your sample is. We're just saying this is what the IMF was saying, but you know, you'd get similar things if you had a bigger sample, but we just, for the purposes of today, I just wanted to do something simple. But as I said, we're dipping our toe into the water in this and experimenting a little, and you know, that's how adoption of new technology works. It takes a while for us to, you know, really integrate it into our work. Fine, please. That is a fantastic question. For the benefit of the recording, it was how we integrate social outcomes, and particularly housing-related and intergenerational housing outcomes, into our economic modelling. I've got sort of a two-part answer to that. And the first is, although it's not something you can kind of easily quantify in an econometric equation, those sort of sensibilities really do matter for our financial stability policy. So one of the things, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, we regard it as a concern, you know, the sort of household balance sheet situation, is, you know, it's not just, well, you know, if there's an economic shock, people who've got a lot of debt will spend less than if they had less debt, and that's therefore bad for the economy in a kind of macro sense. We also believe that, you know, it matters if that 1% fall in consumption, for, you know, just to take a random example, is spread across everybody, or whether it's because 2% of the population are in serious financial distress. So that sort of social element, I mean, you know, the third part of our charter, you know, it's full employment, you know, stability of the currency, full employment, and the welfare of the Australian people. And you can't always put that into econometrics, but it is a sensibility that we have, particularly on the financial stability side. The difficulty we have on the monetary policy side is, you know, we have one interest rate. You know, that's really, other than our sort of open mouth operations, all we can really do is, you know, set an interest rate. And so a lot of those particular policies are beyond our remit, and you know, there's a fine line, you know, in terms of opining on things that are outside our remit. But what I will say is, again, one of the things that, you know, the monetary policy Rip Van Winkle has learned over the last decade is just how, you know, over the last 10 years, micro data, that really disaggregated data, has become much more important in developing our macro understanding. So you don't just look at the macro aggregates anymore. That's kind of, you know, that's 90s thinking. Nowadays, a modern central bank will be looking at the macro data, will be drawing over the word clouds, but also will be looking at, you know, micro data on businesses and on households. And, you know, there's, we've got the Hilda survey. The ABS is doing some amazing things with data linkage at the moment. They've got their Blade database, which is like a longitudinal database of businesses. The census is actually a much richer data set than a lot of people appreciate. So all of the, you know, all of these that are bigger data sets are now sort of becoming integrated. I wouldn't say, you know, that journey isn't complete, but they're now becoming integrated into our general analysis, and you see an awful lot of micro data. So in that respect, so you might have seen there was a, you know, one of our research discussion papers that just came out last week was about using micro data to think about, you know, people's entry into home ownership and how that's changed over time, and it's looking at quite fine-grained distributional concepts. So absolutely we think about it, but not necessarily in our core forecasting equations. Okay, there's one. Going for time?
Okay, so we got a couple of students. We'll start
One there, here, and
and then the last one up.
Okay, fantastic, great. Could you speak up? I'm actually having trouble hearing you.
Sorry, the housing income survey came out. So I was wondering if you had any initial reflections on that.
Not specifically. I mean, the team are currently poring over some of that data at the moment. One thing that the household expenditure survey does provide is new weights for the CPI. And so I think the core thing for us is to see how the CPI weights will change. That will be announced in coming months and will take effect for the December quarter CPI release. And I think that's the thing that we'll be sort of paying first attention to. But again, you know, often you can rummage through these data for months and find more interesting stuff. I mean, that's the nature of the micro data. And finally, over here at sure. Someone's been reading the speech online. So just asked me to talk a little bit about the slack in the labour market here. Well, I mean, essentially it's just that, you know, unemployment's 5.6 and our current best estimate of sort of full employment in the sense that it's the level of employment at which wage growth doesn't pick up is about 5. Plus there's probably a little bit of underemployment in the sense that there are people who are currently working part-time who would like to work more hours, not necessarily have a full-time job, but at least more hours. Plus, one of the things we've noticed is that, I mean, we had very strong employment growth in the last sort of 6 or so months, but a lot of that, we've, you know, the participation rates come up more so than the unemployment rates come down. And so clearly there are other people who, if the jobs are available, they'll be willing to take them even though they're not officially unemployed when the Bureau of Statistics comes around and asks them, have you been actively looking? But they're available if something comes up. So it seems to us that there is a fair bit of spare capacity, particularly in the labour market. And as a consequence, businesses don't generally find they have to start paying higher wages to people until that spare capacity is pretty much eaten away. And so that's why we would regard, you know, wage growth as being likely to only rise fairly slowly from here. And then that in turn is an input into our inflation forecast.
All right, given the time, we should draw to a close. But if everybody could please join me in thanking Lucy very, very much for that detailed